exchanged a few words with the police officer, then rolled up his window. "He said a load of leeches fell from the sky," he said, unmoved. "They got crushed by cars, the road got all slippery, and some drivers lost control. So go slow and take it easy," he told me. "On top of that, some local gang of bikers beat somebody up." Leeches and bikers, what a weird combination. Keeps the police busy, at least. He drove carefully towards the exit. Even going slowly, the lorry slipped a couple of times, and the driver straightened it out with a subtle twist of the wheel. "Man, it really looks like a whole load fell down, and it's damn slippery. But boy, leeches, that's pretty gross. Ever had a leech stick to you?"
"No, as far as Nakata can remember, I don't think so,"
Nakata responded. "I was brought up in the mountains of Gifu, and it happened to me lots of times. I'd be walking in the woods, and they'd fall down from the trees. Go wading in the streams, and they'd stick to your legs. I know a thing or two about leeches, believe me. Once they get stuck on you, they're hard to pull off. If you pull off a big sucker, your skin comes off and you'll have a scar. So the best thing is to burn them off. Awful things, the way they suck your blood. And once they're filled up, they get all soft and mushy. Pretty gross, huh?"
"Yes, it certainly is," Nakata agreed.
"But leeches aren't supposed to fall from the sky into some rest area car park. I never heard of anything so stupid. The guys around here don't know the first thing about leeches. Leeches don't fall from the sky, do they now?"
Nakata said nothing.
"A few years back, a huge number of millipedes appeared all at once in Yamanashi Prefecture, and cars were slipping everywhere. Just like this, the road got all slippery, and there were many accidents. They got all over the tracks, and the trains couldn't run either. But even millipedes aren't going to rain down from the sky. They crawl out from somewhere. Anybody can see that."
"A long time ago, I lived in Yamanashi. During the war."
"No kidding," the driver said. "Which war was that?"
21. Sculptor Koichi Tamura stabbed to death. Found in study, floor a sea of blood. The world-renowned sculptor Koichi Tamura was found dead on the afternoon of the 30th in the study of his home in Nogata, Nakano Ward. The body was discovered by a cleaning lady. Mr. Tamura was found face down, nude, covered in blood. There were signs of a struggle, and the death is being treated as murder. The weapon used was a kitchen knife discovered beside the body. The police estimate the time of death as the evening of the 28th, and since Mr. Tamura lived alone, the body was only discovered 2 days later. Mr. Tamura suffered several deep stab wounds to the chest from the sharp steak knife, and it is believed he died almost instantly of massive loss of blood from injuries to the heart and lungs. In addition, several ribs were broken from what appears to be massive blunt force. The police have not announced the finding of any fingerprints or any other clues left behind at the scene. It appears that there were no witnesses to the crime. Since the house was undisturbed, and valuables and a wallet near the scene were not taken, police view the crime as a personal vendetta. Mr. Tamura's home is in a quiet residential neighbourhood, but no one heard anything at the time of the murder, and neighbours were shocked at the news. Mr. Tamura had little to do with his neighbours, and lived quietly, and no one noticed anything out of the ordinary around the time of the incident. Mr. Tamura lived with his son, 15, but according to the cleaning lady, the son hasn't been seen in some 10 days. The son has also been absent from his junior high, and police are tracing his whereabouts. In addition to his residence, Mr. Tamura had an office and studio in Musashino City, and according to his secretary, until the day before the murder, he was working as usual on a new piece of sculpture. On the day of the incident, there was a matter she had to contact him about, but every time she phoned his residence, she got his answer machine. Mr. Tamura was born in Kokubunji, Tokyo. He entered the Department of Sculpture at Tokyo Arts Institute and, while still a student, completed many innovative pieces that became the talk of the art world. His chief theme was the human subconscious, and his sculptures, which were in a unique style that challenged the conventional, were internationally acclaimed. His best-known work was his major Labyrinth series, which explored, through an uninhibited expression of the imagination, the beauty and inspiration found in the meandering contours of labyrinths. At the time of his death, he was a visiting professor at an art institute. 2 years ago, at an exhibition of his work at the Museum of Modern Art in New York.
I stop reading at this point. There's a photo of our front gate, and one of my father in younger days, and they give the newspaper an ominous feeling. I fold it twice and put it on the table. Still sitting on the bed, I don't say anything, just press my fingertips against my eyes. A dull sound at a constant frequency pounds in my ears. I try shaking my head to get rid of it, but it won't go away. I'm in my room in the library. It's 7 p.m. Oshima and I have just shut the place up for the night, and a while ago Miss Saiki drove off in her Volkswagen Golf. It's just me and Oshima in the library now, and that irritating pounding in my ears. This paper's from a few days ago, while you were up in the mountains. When I saw it, I thought maybe this Koichi Tamura might be your father. A lot of the details fit. I should have shown it to you yesterday, but I wanted to wait until you got settled in. I nod, still pressing my eyes. Oshima doesn't say anything more. I didn't kill him, you know. I know that, Oshima says. On the day of the murder, you were here at the library, reading until evening. You wouldn't have had enough time to go back to Tokyo, murder your father, and then get back to Takamatsu. It's impossible. But I'm not so sure. I do the maths and work out that he was murdered the same night I woke up with my shirt covered in blood. But the paper does say the police are looking for you, as an important witness. I nod. If you go to the police and prove to them you have a firm alibi, it'd make things a lot easier than trying to run around avoiding them. I'll back you up, of course. But if I do that, they'll take me back to Tokyo. I would think so. I mean, you still have to finish junior high. That's the law. You can't go just anywhere you want to at your age. The law says you still need a guardian. I shake my head. I don't want to explain anything to anybody, and I don't want to go back home to Tokyo, or back to school. Quiet for a time, Oshima looks at me intently. That's something you'll have to decide for yourself, he finally says in a calm tone. I think you have a right to live however you want. Whether you're 15 or 51, what does it matter? Unfortunately, society doesn't agree. So let's say you don't explain anything to anybody. You'll be forever on the run from the police and society. Your life will be pretty harsh. You're only 15, with your whole life ahead of you. You're okay with that? I don't say anything. Oshima picks up the paper and scans the article again. According to this, you're your father's only relative. I have a mother and older sister, I explain, but they left a long time ago, and I don't know where they are. Even if I did, I seriously doubt they'd come to the funeral. Well, if you're not there, I wonder who's going to take care of everything. The funeral. His business affairs. As it said in the paper, he has a secretary at his office who's in charge of everything. She knows about his business, so I'm sure she can handle it. I don't want anything of his handed down to me. The house, his estate, whatever. They can get rid of it however they want. The only thing he's handed down to me, I think, are my genes. Correct me if I'm wrong, Oshima says, but you don't seem too upset that your father was murdered. No, I do feel sad. He's my father, after all. But what I really regret is that he didn't die sooner. I know that's a terrible thing to say. Oshima shakes his head. No problem. Now, more than ever, you have the right to be honest. Well, I think... My voice sounds weak, lacking in authority. Unsure of where they're heading, my words are sucked into the void. Oshima comes over and sits down next to me. All kinds of things are happening to me, I begin. Some I chose, some I didn't. I don't know how to tell one from the other anymore. What I mean is, it feels like everything's being decided in advance, that I'm following a path somebody else has already mapped out for me. It doesn't matter how much I think things over, how much effort I put into it. In fact, the harder I try, the more I lose my sense of who I am. It's as if my identity is an orbit that I've strayed far away from, and that really hurts. But more than that, it scares me. Just thinking about it makes me flinch. Oshima reaches to touch my shoulder. I can feel the warmth of his hand. For the sake of argument, let's say all your choices and all your effort are destined to be a waste. You're still very much yourself and nobody else. And you're forging ahead as yourself. So relax. I raise my head and look at him. He sounds so convincing. Why do you think that? Because there's irony involved. Irony? Oshima gazes deep into my eyes. Listen, Kafka. What you're experiencing now is the motif of many Greek tragedies. Man doesn't choose fate. Fate chooses man. That's the basic world view of Greek drama. And the sense of tragedy, according to Aristotle, comes, ironically enough, not from the protagonist's weak points, but from his good qualities. Do you know what I'm getting at? People are drawn deeper into tragedy, not by their defects, but by their virtues. Sophocles' Oedipus Rex being a great example. Oedipus is drawn into tragedy, not because of laziness or stupidity, but because of his courage and honesty. So an inevitable irony results. But it's a hopeless situation. That depends, Oshima says. Sometimes it is. But irony deepens a person, helps them to mature. It's the entrance to salvation on a higher plane, to a place where you can find a more universal kind of hope. That's why people enjoy reading Greek tragedies even now, why they're considered prototypical classics. I'm repeating myself, but everything in life is a metaphor. People don't normally kill their father and sleep with their mother, right? In other words, we accept irony through a device called metaphor, and through that we grow and become deeper human beings. I don't say anything. I'm too involved in thinking about my own situation. How many people know you're in Takamatsu? Oshima asks. I shake my head. Coming here was my own idea, so I don't think anybody else knows. Then you'd better lay low in the library for a while. Don't go out to work at the reception area. I don't think the police will be able to track you down, but if things get sticky, you can always hide out at the cabin. I look at Oshima. If I hadn't met you, I don't think I would have made it. There's nobody else who can help me. Oshima smiles. He takes his hand from my shoulder and stares at his hand. That's not true. If you hadn't met me, I'm sure you would have found another path to take. I don't know why, but I'm certain of it. I just get that feeling about you. He stands up and brings another newspaper from the desk. By the way, this article was in the paper the day before the other one. I remember it because it was so unusual. Maybe it's just coincidence. But it took place near your house.
Fish rain from the sky. 2,000 sardines and mackerel in Nakano Ward shopping district. At around 6 p.m. on the evening of the 29th, residents of the Chome district of Nakano Ward were startled when some 2,000 sardines and mackerel rained down from the sky. Two housewives shopping in the neighbourhood market received slight facial injuries when struck by the falling fish, but no other injuries were reported. At the time of the incident, it was sunny, with no clouds or wind. Many of the fish were still alive and jumped about on the pavement.
I finish reading the article and pass the paper back to Oshima. The reporter speculated about several possible causes of the incident, though none of them is very convincing. The police are investigating the possibility that it involved theft and someone playing a kind of practical joke. The weather service reported that there weren't any atmospheric conditions present that might have led to fish raining from the sky. And from the Ministry of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries spokesman, still no comment. "Do you have any idea why this happened?" Oshima asks me. I shake my head. I don't have a clue. "The day after your father was murdered, close to where it happened, 2,000 sardines and mackerel fell from the sky. Just coincidence?" "I suppose so." The newspaper also says that at the Fujigawa rest area on the Tome Highway, late at night on the very same day, a mass of leeches fell from the sky on one spot. Several minor collisions resulted, they say. Apparently the leeches were quite large. No one can explain why leeches would rain from the sky. It was a clear night, not a cloud in the sky. No idea why this happened either. Again, I shake my head. Oshima folds up the newspaper and says, "Which leaves us with the fact that strange, inexplicable events are occurring one after the other. Maybe it's just a series of coincidences, but it still bothers me. There's something about it I can't unravel." "Maybe it's a metaphor," I venture. "Maybe. But sardines and mackerel and leeches falling from the sky. What kind of metaphor is that?" In the silence, I try putting into words something I haven't been able to say for a long time. "You know something? A few years ago, my father had a prophecy about me." "A prophecy?" "I've never told anybody this before. I thought nobody'd believe me." Oshima doesn't say a word, but his silence encourages me. More a curse than a prophecy, I guess. My father told me this over and over, as though he were chiseling each word into my brain. I take a deep breath and check once more what it is I have to say. Not that I really need to check it. It's always there, banging about in my head, whether I examine it or not. But I have to weigh the words one more time. And this is what I say. "Someday, you will murder your father and be with your mother," he said. Once I've spoken this, put this thought into concrete words, a hollow feeling grabs hold of me. And inside that hollow, my heart pounds out a vacant, metallic rhythm. Expression unchanged, Oshima gazes at me for a long time. "So he said that someday you would kill your father with your own hands, that you would sleep with your mother." I nod a few more times. "The prophecy made about Oedipus. Though, of course, you knew that." I nod. "But that's not all. There's an extra ingredient he threw into the mix. I have a sister, 6 years older than I am, and my father said I would be with her, too." "Your father actually said this to you?" "Yeah. I was still in elementary school then, and didn't know what he meant by be with. It was a few years before I caught on." Oshima doesn't say anything. "My father told me there was nothing I could do to escape this fate. That prophecy is like a timing device buried inside my genes, and nothing can ever change it. I will kill my father and be with my mother and sister." Oshima stays silent for quite some time, as if he's inspecting each word I've spoken, one by one, examining them for clues to what this is all about. "Why in the world would your father tell you such an awful thing?" he finally asks. "I have no idea. He didn't explain it beyond that," I say, shaking my head. "Maybe he wanted revenge on his wife and daughter who left him. Wanted to punish them, perhaps. Through me." "Even if it meant hurting you?" I nod. "To my father, I'm probably nothing more than one of his sculptures. Something he could make or break as he sees fit." "That's a pretty twisted way of thinking," Oshima says. "In our home, everything was twisted. And when everything's twisted, what's normal ends up looking weird too. I've known this for a long time, but I was a child. Where else could I go?" I've seen your father's work a number of times, Oshima replies. He's a wonderful sculptor. His pieces are original, provocative, powerful. Uncompromising is how I'd put it. Most definitely the real thing. Maybe so. But the dregs left over from creating these he spread everywhere like a poison you can't escape. My father polluted everything he touched, damaged everyone around him. I don't know if he did it because he wanted to. Maybe he had to. Maybe it's just part of his makeup. Anyway, I get the feeling he was connected to something very unusual. Do you have any idea what I mean? Yeah, I think so, Oshima says. Something beyond good and evil. The source of power, you might call it. And half my genes were made up of that. Maybe that's why my mother abandoned me. Maybe she wanted to cut herself off from me because I was born from this terrible source, because I was polluted. Oshima lightly presses his fingertips against his temples as he mulls this over. He narrows his eyes and stares at me. Is there any chance he's not your biological father? I shake my head. A few years ago, we got tested at a hospital. The two of us had a DNA check done on our blood. No doubt about it. Biologically, we're father and son 100%. They showed me the results of the tests. Very cautious of him. I guess he wanted me to know that I was one of the works he'd created, something he'd finished and signed. Oshima's fingers stay pressed to his temples. But your father's prophecy didn't come true, did it? You didn't murder him. You were here in Takamatsu when it happened. Somebody else killed him in Tokyo. Silently, I spread my hands out in front of me and stare at them. Those hands that, in the darkness of night, had been covered with blood. I'm not so sure of that, I tell him. And I proceed to tell him everything. How on that night, on my way back to the hotel, I'd lost consciousness for a few hours. About waking up in the woods behind the shrine, my shirt sticky with somebody's blood. About washing the blood off in the toilet, how several hours had been erased from my memory. To save time, I don't go into how I stayed overnight at Sakura's. Oshima asks the occasional question and files away the details in his head. He doesn't voice any opinions, though. I have no idea how that blood got all over me, or whose blood it could be. It's a complete blank, I tell him. But maybe I did kill my father with my own hands, not metaphorically. I really get the feeling that I did. As you said, I was in Takamatsu that day. I definitely didn't go to Tokyo. But in dreams begin responsibility, right? Oshima nods. Yates. So maybe I murdered him through a dream, I say. Maybe I went through some special dream circuit or something and killed him. To you that might feel like the truth, but nobody's going to grill you about your poetic responsibilities. Certainly not the police. Nobody can be in two places at once. It's a scientific fact. Einstein and all that. And the law accepts that principle. But I'm not talking about science or law here. What you're talking about, Kafka, Oshima says, is just a theory. A bold, surrealistic theory, to be sure, but one that belongs in a science fiction novel. Of course it's just a theory. I know that. I don't think anybody else is going to believe such a stupid thing. But my father always used to say that, without counter-evidence to refute a theory, science would never progress. A theory is a battlefield in your head. That was his pet phrase. And right now, I can't think of any evidence to counter my hypothesis. Oshima is silent. And I can't think of anything else to say. Anyway, Oshima finally says, that's why you ran away to Shikoku. To escape your father's curse. I nod and point to the folded-up newspaper. But it looks as though there's no escape. Distance won't solve anything, the boy named Crow says. Well, you definitely need a hiding place, Oshima says. Beyond that, There's not much I can say. I suddenly realize how exhausted I am. I lean against Oshima, and he wraps his arms around me. I push my face against his flat chest. Oshima, I don't want to do those things. I don't want to kill my father, or be with my mother and sister. Of course you don't, he replies, running his fingers through my short hair. How could you? Not even in dreams. Or in a metaphor, Oshima adds. Or in an allegory. Or an analogy. He pauses and then says, If you don't mind, I'll stay with you here tonight. I can sleep on the chair. But I turn him down. I think I'm better off alone for a while, I tell him. Oshima brushes the strands of hair off his forehead. After hesitating a bit, he says, I know I'm a hopeless, damaged, homosexual gay woman. And if that's what's bothering you... No, I say. That's not it at all. I just need some time alone to think. Too many things have happened at once, that's all. Oshima writes down a phone number on a memo pad. In the middle of the night, if you feel like talking to anybody, call this number. Don't hesitate, okay? I'm a light sleeper anyway. I thank him. That's the night I see a ghost.
22. The lorry Nakata was riding in arrived in Kobe just after 5 in the morning. It was light out, but the warehouse was still closed and their freight couldn't be unloaded. They parked in a broad street near the harbour and took a nap. The young driver stretched out on the back seat, his usual spot for napping, and was soon snoring contentedly. His snores sometimes woke Nakata, but each time he soon dropped back into a comfortable sleep. Insomnia was one phenomenon Nakata had never experienced. A little before 8, the young driver sat up and gave a big yawn. "Hey, Gramps, you hungry?" he asked. He was busy shaving with an electric razor, using the rear-view mirror.
"Now that you mention it, yes, Nakata does feel a little hungry.
Well, let's go and grab some breakfast." From when they left Fujigawa to their arrival in Kobe, Nakata had spent much of the time sleeping. The young driver hardly said a word, just drove on, listening to a late-night radio show. Occasionally he'd sing along to a song, none of which Nakata had ever heard before. He wondered if they were even in Japanese, since he could barely understand any of the lyrics, just the odd word. From his bag he took out the chocolate and rice balls he'd got from the two young office girls in Shinjuku and shared them. The driver had chain-smoked, saying it helped to keep him awake, so Nakata's clothes were reeking of smoke by the time they arrived in Kobe. Bag and umbrella in hand, Nakata clambered down from the lorry. "You can leave that stuff in the lorry," the driver said. "We're not going far, and we'll come straight back after we eat."
"Yes, you're quite right, but Nakata feels better having them."
The young man frowned. "Whatever. It's not like I'm lugging them around, it's up to you."
"Much obliged."
"My name's Hoshino, by the way. Spelled the same way as the former manager of the Chunichi Dragons. We're not related, though."
"Mr. Hoshino, is it? Very glad to meet you. My name is Nakata."
"Come on, I knew that already," Hoshino said. He knew the neighborhood and strode off down the street, Nakata almost having to trot to keep up. They ended up in a small cafe down a back street, seated among other lorry drivers and stevedores from the docks. Not a single tie in sight. All of them were intently shoveling in their breakfast, as if they were filling up a petrol tank. The place was alive with the clatter of dishes, the waitress yelling out orders, the morning NHK news on the TV buzzing in one corner. Oshino pointed to the menu taped to the wall.
"Order whatever you want, Gramps. The food's cheap here and pretty good."
"All right," Nakata said, and did as he was told, staring at the menu until he remembered he couldn't read. "I'm sorry, Mr. Hoshino, but I'm not very bright and can't read."
"Is that so?"
Hoshino said, amazed.
"Can't read? That's pretty rare these days. But that's okay. I'm having the grilled fish and omelette. Why don't you get the same?"
"That sounds good. Grilled fish and omelettes are some of Nakata's favorites."
"Glad to hear it.
I enjoy eel a lot, too.
Yeah, I like eel myself, but eel's not something you have in the morning, is it?
That's right. And Nakata had eel last night when Mr. Hagita bought some for me.
Glad to hear it, Hoshino said again. 2 orders of the grilled fish set plus omelettes, he yelled to the waitress, and supersize one of the rices, okay? 2 grilled fish sets plus omelettes, 1 rice, supersize, the waitress called loudly to the cooks. Isn't it kind of a pain not being able to read? Hoshino asked.
Yes, sometimes I have trouble because I can't read. As long as I stay in Nakano Ward in Tokyo, it's not so bad. But if I go somewhere else, like now, it's very hard for me.
I guess so. Kobe's pretty far from Nakano.
Nakata doesn't know north and south. All I know is left and right. So I get lost and can't buy tickets either.
Incredible you were able to get this far.
Many people were kind enough to help me. You're one of them, Mr. Hoshino. I don't know how to thank you.
That must be tough, though, not being able to read. My granddad was pretty senile, but he could still read well enough.
I'm especially dumb.
Is everybody in your family like that?
No, they aren't. One brother is a department head at a place called Itochu, and the other brother works at an office called M-E-T-E.
Wow, Hoshino said. Pretty elite bunch. So you're the only one who's a bit off, huh?
Yes, Nakata's the only one who had an accident and isn't bright. That's why I'm always being told not to go out too much and cause any trouble for my brothers, nieces and nephews.
Yeah, I guess most people would find it awkward to have someone like you turning up.
I don't understand difficult things, but I know that as long as I stay in Nakano Ward, I don't get lost. The governor helped me out, and I get along well with cats. Once a month I get my hair cut, and every once in a while I eat eel. But after Johnny Walker, Nakata couldn't stay in Nakano anymore.
Johnny Walker?
That's right. He has boots and a tall black hat and a waistcoat and walking stick. He collects cats to get their souls.
You don't say, Hoshino said. I don't have much patience with long stories. So anyway, something happened and you left Nakano, right?
That's right. I left Nakano.
So where are you headed?
Nakata doesn't know yet. But after we got here, I knew I had to go across a bridge. A big bridge near here.
Ah, so you're going to Shikoku.
I'm very sorry, Mr. Hoshino, but I don't know geography very well. If you cross the bridge, are you in Shikoku?
Yeah. If you're talking about a big bridge round here, that's the one to Shikoku. There are 3 of them, actually. One goes from Kobe to Awaji Island, then on to Tokushima. Another goes from below Kurashiki over to Sakede. And one connects Onomichi and Imabari. One bridge would have been plenty, but politicians stuck their noses into it, and they wound up with 3. Your typical folk-winning projects.
Hoshino poured some water onto the resin tabletop and drew an abbreviated map of Japan with his finger, indicating the 3 bridges connecting Honshu and Shikoku.
Are these bridges really big?
Nakata asked.
They're huge.
Is that right? Anyway, Nakata's going to cross over one of them. Probably whichever one is closest. I'll work out what to do after that later on.
So what you're saying is you don't have any friends or anybody where you're headed?
No, Nakata doesn't know anybody there.
You're just going to cross the bridge to Shikoku and then find somewhere else to go?
That's right.
And you don't know where that somewhere is?
I have no idea, but I think I'll know it when I get there.
Jeez,
Hoshino said. He brushed back his hair, gave his ponytail a tug, and put on his Chunichi dragon's cap. Their food was served, and they started eating.
Pretty good omelette, eh? Hoshino asked.
Yes, it's very good. It tastes different from the omelettes I always eat in Nakano.
That's because it's Kansai style. Not at all like those tasteless flat things that pass as omelettes in Tokyo.
The two of them silently enjoyed their meal. The omelettes, salt-grilled mackerel, miso soup with shellfish, pickled turnips, seasoned spinach, seaweed. They didn't leave a grain of rice. Nagata made sure to chew each bite 32 times, so it took quite a while for him to finish.
Good enough, Mr. Nagata?
Yes, plenty. How about you, Mr. Hoshino?
Hey, mate, I'm stuffed. Perks up the old spirits, doesn't it, to have such a great breakfast?
Yes, it certainly does.
How about it? Got to take a dump.
Now that you mention it, I do feel like it.
Go right ahead. Toilet's over there.
What about you, Mr. Hoshino?
I'll go later on. Take my time about it.
Thank you. Nagata will go and take a dump, then.
Hey, not so loud. People are still eating here.
I'm sorry. Nakata's not very bright.
Never mind. Just go.
Do you mind if I brush my teeth, too?
No, go ahead. We've got time. Do whatever you want. Tell you what, I don't think you'll be needing that umbrella. You're only going to the toilet, right?
All right. I'll leave the umbrella.
When Nakata came back from the toilet, Hoshino had already paid their bill.
Mr. Hoshino, I have money with me, so please let me at least pay for breakfast.
Hoshino shook his head. It's okay. I owe my grandpa big time. Then I was kind of wild.
I see. But I'm not your grandfather.
That's my problem, so don't worry about it. No arguments, okay? Let me treat you.
After a moment's thought, Nakata decided to accept the young man's generosity.
Thank you so much, then. It was a wonderful meal.
Hey, it's just some mackerel and omelettes and a nothing little calf. No need to bow like that.
But you know, Mr. Hoshino, ever since Nakata left Nakano Ward, everyone's been so nice to me, I've hardly had to use any money at all.
Sweet, Hoshino said, impressed.
Nakata had a waitress fill his little thermos with hot tea, then he carefully replaced it in his bag. Walking back to where the lorry was parked, Hoshino said,
So, about this going to Shikoku thing?
Yes,
Nakata replied.
Why do you want to go there?
I don't know.
You don't know why you're going, or even where you're going, but you've still got to go to Shikoku.
That's right. Nakata's going to cross a big bridge.
Things'll be clearer once you're on the other side?
I think so. I won't know anything until I cross the bridge.
Hoshino said. So crossing that bridge is very important.
Yes, that's more important than anything.
Man alive,
Hoshino said, scratching his head.
The young man had to drive his lorry over to the warehouse to deliver his load of furniture, so he told Nakata to wait for him in a small park near the harbour.
Don't move from here, okay? Hoshino cautioned him. There's a toilet over there and a water fountain. You've got everything you need. If you wander off somewhere, you might not find your way back.
I understand. I'm not in Nakano Ward anymore.
Exactly. This isn't Nakano. So sit tight and I'll be back really soon.
All right. I'll stay right here.
Good. I'll be back as soon as I do my delivery.
Nakata did as he was told, not moving from the bench, not even to use the toilet. He didn't find staying put in one place for a long time very hard. Sitting still, in fact, was his speciality. He could see the sea from where he sat. This he hadn't seen for a long, long time. When he was little, he and his family had gone to the seaside any number of times. He'd put on swimming trunks, splash around on the shore, gather seashells at low tide. But these memories weren't clear. It was like this had taken place in another world. Since then, he couldn't recall seeing the sea even once. After the strange incident in the hills of Yamanashi, Nakata went back to school in Tokyo. He'd regained consciousness, and physically he was fine, but his memory had been wiped clean, and he never regained the ability to read and write. He couldn't read his school textbooks and couldn't take any tests. All the knowledge he'd gained up till then had vanished, as had the ability, to a great extent, to think in abstract terms. Even so, they let him graduate.
He couldn't follow what was being taught, and instead sat quietly in a corner of the classroom. When the teacher told him to do something, he followed her instructions to the letter. He didn't bother anyone, so teachers tended to forget he was there. He was more like a guest sitting in than a burden. People soon forgot that until the accident he'd always got straight A's. But now the school activities and events took place without him. He didn't make any friends. None of this bothered him, though. Being left alone meant that he could be lost in his own little world. What absorbed him most at school was taking care of the rabbits and goats they raised there, tending the flower beds outside and cleaning the classrooms. A constant smile on his face, he never tired of these chores. He was, for the most part, forgotten about at home, too. Once they learned that their eldest son couldn't read any more or follow along with his lessons, Nakata's parents, totally focused on their children's education, ignored him and turned their attention to his younger brothers. It was impossible for Nakata to go on to public junior high, so once he graduated from elementary school, he was sent to live with relatives in Nagano Prefecture in his mother's hometown. There he attended agriculture school. Since he still couldn't read, he had a hard time with his schoolwork, but he loved working in the fields. He might even have become a farmer if his classmates hadn't tormented him so much. They enjoyed beating up this outsider, this city kid, so much. His injuries became so severe, one cauliflower ear included, that his grandparents took him out of the school and kept him at home to help out around the house. Nakata was a quiet, obedient child, and his grandparents loved him very much. It was about this time that he discovered he could speak to cats. His grandparents had a few cats around the house, and Nakata became good friends with them. At first he was able to speak only a few words, but he knuckled down as though he was trying to master a foreign language, and before long he was able to carry on extended conversations. Whenever he was free, he liked to sit on the porch and talk to the cats. For their part, the cats taught him a lot about nature and the world around him. In fact, almost all the basic knowledge he had about the world and how it worked, he learned from his feline friends. At 15, he was sent to a nearby furniture company to learn woodwork. It was less a factory than a small woodworking shop making folk-craft-type furniture. Chairs, tables, and chests made there were shipped to Tokyo. Nakata grew to love woodwork. His boss took a great liking to him, for he was skilled with his hands, never skipped any small details, didn't talk much, and never, ever complained. Reading a design and adding figures weren't his forte, but apart from these tasks, he did well at everything he set his hand to. Once he got the manufacturing steps in his mind, he could repeat them endlessly, tirelessly. After a 2-year apprenticeship, he was given full-time employment. Nakata worked there until he was past 50, never once having an accident or calling in sick. He didn't drink or smoke, didn't stay up late or overeat. He never watched TV and listened to the radio only for the morning exercise program. Day after day, he just made furniture. His grandparents eventually passed away, as did his parents. Everybody liked him, though he didn't make any close friends. Perhaps that was only to be expected. When most people tried talking to Nakata, 10 minutes was all it took for them to run out of things to say. Still, he never felt lonely or unhappy. He never felt sexual desire or even wanted to be with anyone. He understood he was different from other people. Though no one else noticed this, he thought his shadow on the ground was paler, lighter than that of other people. The only ones who really understood him were the cats. On his days off, he'd sit on a park bench and spend the whole day chatting with them. Strangely enough, with cats, he never ran out of things to talk about. The owner of the furniture company passed away when Nakata was 52, and the woodworking shop was closed soon afterwards. That kind of gloomy, dark, traditional furniture didn't sell as well as it used to. The craftsmen were all getting on in years, and no young people were interested in learning the trade. The shop itself, originally in the middle of a field, was now surrounded by newly built homes, and complaints started to come in about both the noise and the smoke when they burned wood shavings. The owner's son, who worked in town for an accounting firm, had no interest in taking over the business, so as soon as his father passed away, he sold the property to a property developer. For his part, the developer tore down the factory, had the land levelled, and sold it to an apartment complex developer, who built a 6-story building on the plot. Every apartment in the complex sold out on the first day they were put on sale. That's how Nakata lost his job. The company had some loans to pay off, so he received only a pittance as retirement pay. Afterwards, he couldn't find another job. Who was going to hire an illiterate man in his 50s, whose only skill was crafting antique furniture which nobody wanted any more? Nakata had worked steadily for 37 years at the factory without taking a single day of leave, so he did have a fair amount of money in his savings account at the local post office. He generally spent very little on himself, so even without finding another job, he should have been able to have a comfortable old age on his savings. Since he couldn't read or write, a cousin of his who worked at the town hall managed his account for him. Though kind enough, this cousin wasn't so quick on the uptake and was tricked into investing in a complex at a ski resort by an unscrupulous property broker and ended up deeply in debt. Around the same time that Nakata lost his job, this cousin disappeared with his whole family to escape his creditors. Some Yakuza-type loan sharks were after him, apparently. Nobody knew where this family was, or even if they were still alive. When Nakata had an acquaintance go with him to the post office to check on the balance in his account, he found out that only 10,000 yen was left. His retirement pay, which had been deposited directly into the account, had also vanished. All that could be said was that Nakata was extremely unlucky, losing his job and finding himself penniless. His relatives were sympathetic, but they'd been asked to put up collateral and likewise lost everything they'd invested with the cousin, so none of them had the resources to help Nakata in his time of need. In the end, the older of Nakata's two brothers in Tokyo decided to look after him for the time being. He owned a small apartment building in Nakano that catered for single men. This was part of his inheritance from his parents, and he offered one of the units to his older brother. He also looked after the money his parents had willed to Nakata, not a great amount, and arranged for him to receive a subsidy for the mentally challenged from the Tokyo Metropolitan Government. That was the extent of the brother's care. Despite his illiteracy, Nakata was able to look after his daily needs by himself, and as long as his rent was covered, he was able to manage. His two brothers had very little contact with him. They saw him a few times when he first moved back to Tokyo, but that was it. They had lived apart for more than 30 years, and their lifestyles were too different. Neither brother had any particular feelings towards him, and in any case they were too busy with their own careers to take care of a retarded sibling. But this cold treatment by his family didn't faze Nakata. He was used to being alone, and actually tensed up if people went out of their way to be nice to him. Nor was he angry that his cousin had squandered his life savings. Naturally, he understood it was bad it happened, but he wasn't disappointed by the whole affair. Nakata had no idea what a resort complex was, or what investing meant, nor did he understand what taking out a loan involved. He lived in a world circumscribed by a very limited vocabulary. Only amounts up to 5,000 yen or so had any meaning to him. Anything above that, 100,000 yen, 1 million yen, 10 million yen, was all the same to him. A lot of money, that's all it meant. He might have savings, but he'd never seen them. They just told him, "This is how much you have in your account," and told him an amount, which to him was an abstract concept. So when it all vanished, he never had the sense that he'd actually lost something real. So Nakata lived a contented life in the small apartment his brother provided, receiving his monthly subsidy, using his special bus pass, going to the local park to chat with the cats. This little corner of Nakano became his new world. Just like dogs and cats, he marked off his territory, a boundary line beyond which, except in unusual circumstances, he never ventured. As long as he stayed there, he felt safe and content. No dissatisfactions, no anger at anything, no feelings of loneliness, anxieties about the future, or worries that his life was difficult or inconvenient. Day after day, for more than 10 years, this was his life, leisurely enjoying whatever came along. Until the day that Johnny Walker turned up. Nakata hadn't seen the sea in years, for there was no sea in Nagano Prefecture or in Nakano Ward. Now, for the first time, he realized that he'd lost the sea for so long. He hadn't even thought about it all those many years. He nodded several times to himself, confirming this fact. He took off his hat, rubbed his closely cropped head with his palm, put his hat back on, and gazed out at the sea. This is the extent of his knowledge of the sea. It was very big, it was salty, and fish lived there. He sat there on the bench, breathing in the scent of the sea, watching seagulls circle overhead, gazing at ships anchored far offshore. He didn't tire of the view. An occasional white seagull would alight on the fresh summer grass in the park. The white against the green was beautiful. Nakata tried calling out to the seagull as it walked over the grass, but it didn't reply and only stared coolly at him. There were no cats around. The only animals in the park were seagulls and sparrows. As he sipped hot tea from his thermos, rain began pelting down, and Nakata opened up his precious umbrella. By the time Hoshino came back to the park just before 12, it had stopped raining. Nakata was seated on the bench just as he'd left him, umbrella folded, staring out at the sea. Hoshino had parked his lorry somewhere and arrived in a taxi. "Hey, I'm sorry it took so long," he apologized. A vinyl Boston bag hung from his shoulder. "I thought I'd be finished sooner, but all kinds of things came up. It seems that every department store has one guy who's got to be a pain in the ass."
"Nakata didn't mind at all. I was just sitting here, looking at the sea."
Hoshino murmured. He looked out in the same direction, but all he saw was a shabby old pier and oil on the surface of the water.
"I haven't seen the sea in a long time."
"Is that right?"
"The last time I saw it was in elementary school. I went to the seaside at Enoshima."
"I bet that was a long time ago."
"Japan was occupied by the Americans then. The seashore at Enoshima was filled with American soldiers."
"You've got to be kidding."
"No, I'm not kidding."
"Come on," Hoshino said. "Japan was never occupied by America."
"Nakata doesn't know the details, but America had planes called B-29s. They dropped a lot of bombs on Tokyo, so I went to Yamanashi Prefecture. That's where I got sick."
"Yeah? Whatever. I told you I don't like long stories. Anyway, let's press on. It took longer than I thought, and it's going to be dark soon if we don't get a move on."
"Where are we going?"
"Shikoku, of course. We'll cross the bridge. You said you're going to Shikoku, didn't you?"
"I did. But what about your job?"
"Don't worry about it. It'll still be there when I get back. I've been putting in some long hours and was thinking that I should take a few days off. To tell the truth, I've never been to Shikoku myself. Might as well check it out. Plus you can't read, right? So it'll be a whole lot easier if I'm with you to help buy the tickets. Unless you don't want me along."
"No. Nakata would be happy to have you along."
"Then let's do it. I already checked the bus timetable. Shikoku, here we come."
23. I don't know if ghost is the right word, but it definitely isn't something of this world. That much I can tell at a glance. I sense something, and suddenly wake up, and there she is. It's the middle of the night, but the room is strangely light. Moonlight streaming through the window. I know I closed the curtains before going to bed, but now they're wide open. The girl's silhouette is clearly outlined, bathed by the bone-white light of the moon. She's about my age, 15 or 16. I'm guessing 15. There's a big difference between 15 and 16. She's small and slim, holds herself erect, and doesn't seem delicate at all. Her hair hangs down to her shoulders, with a fringe on her forehead. She's wearing a blue dress with a billowing hem that's just the right length. She doesn't have on any shoes or socks. The buttons on the cuffs of her dress are neatly done up. Her dress has a rounded, open collar, showing off her well-formed neck. She's sitting at the desk, chin resting in her hands, staring at the wall and thinking about something. Nothing too complex, I'd say. It looks more as if she's lost in some pleasant, warm memory of not so long ago. Every once in a while, a hint of a smile gathers at the corners of her mouth. But the shadows cast by the moonlight keep me from making out any details of her expression. I don't want to interrupt whatever it is she's doing, so I pretend to be asleep, holding my breath and trying not to be noticed. She has to be a ghost. First of all, she's just too beautiful. Her features are gorgeous. But it's not only that. She's so perfect, I know she can't be real. She's like a person who stepped right out of a dream. The purity of her beauty gives me a feeling close to sadness. A very natural feeling, though one that only something extraordinary could induce. I'm wrapped in my covers, holding my breath. She continues to sit there at the desk, chin propped in her hands, barely stirring. Now and then, her chin shifts a fraction, changing the angle of her head ever so slightly. As far as anything moving in the room, that's it. I can see the large flowering dogwood just outside the window glistening in the moonlight. There's no wind, and I can't hear a sound. The whole thing feels as though I might have died unknowing. I'm dead, and this girl and I have sunk to the bottom of a deep crater lake. All of a sudden, she pulls her hands away from her chin and places them on her lap. Two small, pale knees show at her hemline. She stops gazing at the wall and turns in my direction. She reaches up and touches the hair at her forehead. Her slim, girlish fingers resting for a time on her forehead, as if she's trying to draw out some forgotten thought. She's looking at me. My heart beats dully in my chest. But strangely, I don't feel as though I'm being looked at. Maybe she's not looking at me, but beyond me. In the depths of our crater lake, all is silent. The volcano's been extinct for ages, layer upon layer of solitude, like folds of soft mud. The little bit of light that manages to penetrate to the depths lights up the surroundings like the remnants of some faint, distant memory. At these depths, there's no sign of life. I don't know how long she looks at me, not at me, maybe, but at the spot where I am. Time's rules don't apply here. Time expands, then contracts, all in tune with the stirrings of the heart. And then, without warning, the girl stands up and walks to the door on her slender legs. The door is shut, yet soundlessly she disappears. I stay where I am in bed. My eyes open just a slit, and I don't move a muscle. For all I know, she might come back, I think. I want her to, I realize. But no matter how long I wait, she doesn't return. I raise my head and glance at the fluorescent numbers on the alarm clock next to my bed. 3:25. I get out of bed, go to the chair she was sitting on, and touch it. It's not warm at all. I check out the desktop, in the hope of finding something, a single hair perhaps she left behind. But there's nothing. I sit on the chair, massaging my cheeks with the palms of my hands, and breathe a deep sigh. I close the curtains and crawl back under the covers, but there's no way I can go back to sleep now. My head's too full of that enigmatic girl. A strange, terrific force unlike anything I've ever experienced is sprouting in my heart, taking root there, growing. Shut up behind my ribcage, my warm heart expands and contracts independent of my will, over and over. I switch on the light and wait for the dawn, sitting up in bed. I can't read, can't listen to music. I can't do anything but sit there, waiting for morning to come. As the sky begins to lighten, I do sleep a bit. When I wake up, my pillow's cold and damp with tears. But tears for what? I have no idea. Around 9, Oshima roars up in his Miata, and we get the library ready to open. After everything's done, I make him some coffee. He taught me how to do it just right. You grind the beans by hand,